Claire. I'm sorry. I can't help it. It's funny, too, because I was just lying here thinking what a blessing today was. To be here with you making love instead of being chased by thugs or freezing to death in some barn or some of the other stupid shit I get to deal with. And when I go back, I'm with you. And today it was wonderful. She's smiling a little. I kiss her. How come I always have to wait? Because you have perfect DNA, and you aren't being thrown around in time like a hot potato. Besides, patience is a virtue. Claire's pummeling my chest with her fists lightly. Also, you've known me your whole life, whereas I only meet you when I'm 28. So I spend all those years before we meet fucking other women. Well, yeah, but unbeknownst to me, it's all just practice for when I meet you. And it's very lonely and weird. If you don't believe me, try it yourself. I'll never know. It's different when you don't care. I don't want anybody else. Good. Henry, just give me a hint. Where do you live? Where do we meet? What day? One hint. Chicago. More. Have faith. It's all there in front of you. Are we happy? We are often insane with happiness. We are also very unhappy for reasons neither of us can do anything about. Like being separated. So all the time you're here now, you're not with me then? Well, not exactly. I may end up missing only 10 minutes. Or 10 days, there's no rule about it. That's what makes it hard. For you. Also, I sometimes end up in dangerous situations, and I come back to you broken and messed up. And you worry about me when I'm gone. It's like marrying a policeman. I'm exhausted. I wonder how old I actually am in real time. In calendar time, I'm 41. But with all this coming and going, perhaps I'm really 45 or 6. Or maybe I'm 39, who knows? There's something I have to tell her. What was it? Claire? Henry? When you see me again, remember that I won't know you. Don't be upset when you see me and I treat you like a total stranger, because to me, you'll be brand new. And please, don't blow my mind with everything all at once. Have mercy, Claire. I will. Oh, Henry, stay. Shh. I'll be with you. We lie down again. The exhaustion permeates me, and I'll be gone in a minute. I love you, Henry. Thank you for my birthday present. I love you, Claire. Be good. I'm gone.
Secret. Thursday, February 10th, 2005. Claire is 33, Henry is 41. It's Thursday afternoon, and I'm in the studio making pale yellow Kozo paper. Henry's been gone for almost 24 hours now, and as usual, I'm torn between thinking obsessively about when and where he might be, and being pissed at him for not being here, and worrying about when he'll be back. It's not helping my concentration, and I'm ruining a lot of sheets. I plop them off the sous and back into the vat. Finally, I take a break and pour myself a cup of coffee. It's cold in the studio, and the water in the vat is supposed to be cold, although I have warmed it a little to save my hands from cracking. I wrap my hands around the ceramic mug. Steam wafts up. I put my face over it, inhale the moisture and coffee smell. And then, oh, thank you, God, I hear Henry whistling as he comes up the path through the garden into the studio. He stomps the snow off his boots and shrugs off his coat. He's looking marvelous, really happy. My heart is racing, and I take a wild guess. May 24th, 1989? Yes! Oh, yes! Henry scoops me up, wet apron and Wellingtons and all, and swings me around. Now I'm laughing. We're both laughing. Henry exudes delight. Why didn't you tell me? I've been needlessly wondering all these years, Vixen, Minx. He's biting my neck and tickling me. But you didn't know, so I couldn't tell you. Oh, right. My God, you're amazing. We sit on the grungy old studio couch. Can we turn up the heat in here? Sure. Henry jumps up and turns the thermostat higher. The furnace kicks in. How long was I gone? Almost a whole day. Henry sighs. Was it worth it? A day of anxiety in exchange for a few really beautiful hours? Yes. That was one of the best days of my life. I am quiet, remembering. I often invoke the memory of Henry's face above me, surrounded by blue sky and the feeling of being permeated by him. I think about it when he's gone and I'm having trouble sleeping. Tell me. Hmm? We are wrapped around each other, for warmth, for reassurance. What happened after I left? I picked everything up and made myself more or less presentable and went back up to the house. I got upstairs without running into anyone, and I took a bath. After a while, Etta started hammering on the door, wanting to know why I was in the tub in the middle of the day, and I had to pretend I was sick. And I was, in a way. I spent the summer lounging around, sleeping a lot, reading. I just kind of rolled up into myself. I spent some time down in the meadow, sort of hoping you might show up. I wrote you letters. I burned them. I stopped eating for a while, and Mom dragged me to her therapist, and I started eating again. At the end of August, my parents informed me that if I didn't perk up, I wouldn't be going to school that fall, so I immediately perked up because my whole goal in life was to get out of the house and go to Chicago. And school was a good thing. It was new, I had an apartment, I loved the city. I had something to think about besides the fact that I had no idea where you were or how to find you. By the time I finally did run into you, I was doing pretty well. I was into my work, I had friends. I got asked out quite a bit. Oh? Sure. Did you go? Out? Well, yeah, I did. In the spirit of research. And because I occasionally got mad that somewhere out there you were obliviously dating other women. But it was all a sort of black comedy. I would go out with some perfectly nice, pretty young art boy and spend the whole evening thinking about how boring and futile it was and checking my watch. I stopped after five of them because I could see that I was really pissing these guys off. Someone put the word out at school that I was a dyke, and then I got a wave of girls asking me out. I could see you as a lesbian. Yeah, behave yourself or I'll convert. I've always wanted to be a lesbian. Henry is looking dreamy and heavy-lidded. Not fair when I am wound up and ready to jump on him. He yawns. Oh well, not in this lifetime. Too much surgery. In my head, I hear the voice of Father Compton behind the grill of the confessional, softly asking me if there is anything else I want to confess. No, I tell him firmly. No, there isn't. That was a mistake. I was drunk, and it doesn't count. The good father sighs and pushes the curtain across. End of confession. My penance is to lie to Henry, by omission, as long as we both shall live. I look at him, happily postprandial, sated with the charms of my younger self, and the image of Gomez sleeping. Gomez's bedroom in morning light flashes across my mental theater. It was a mistake, Henry, I tell him silently. I was waiting, and I got sideswiped just once. Tell him, says Father Compton, or somebody in my head. I can't, I retort. He'll hate me. Hey, Henry says gently. Where are you? Thinking. You look so sad. Do you worry sometimes that all the really great stuff has already happened? No. Well, sort of, but in a different way than you mean. I'm still moving through the time you're reminiscing about, so it's not really gone for me. I worry that we aren't paying close attention here and now. That is, time travel is sort of an altered state, so I'm more aware when I'm out there, and it seems important somehow. And sometimes I think that if I could just be that aware here and now, that things would be perfect. But there's been some great things lately. He smiles. That beautiful, crooked, radiant smile, all innocence. And I allow my guilt to subside, back to the little box where I keep it crammed in like a parachute. Alba. Alba is perfect. And you are perfect. I mean, as much as I love you, back there, it's the shared life, the knowing each other, through thick and thin. The fact that there are bad times makes it more real. It's the reality I want. Tell him, tell him. Even reality can be pretty unreal. If I'm ever going to say it, now's the time. He waits. I just can't. Claire? I regard him miserably, like a child caught in a complicated fib. And then I say it, almost inaudibly. I slept with someone. Henry's face is frozen, disbelieving. Who? He asks, without looking at me. Gomez? Why? Henry is still waiting for the blow. I was drunk. We were at a party, and Charisse was in Boston. Wait a minute, when was this? 1990? He starts to laugh. Oh, God, Claire, don't do that to me, shit. 1990? Jesus, I thought you were telling me something that happened, like, last week. I smile, weakly. He says, I mean, it's not like I'm overjoyed about it, but since I just got through telling you to go out and experiment, I can't really... I don't know. He's getting restless. He gets up and starts pacing around the studio. I am incredulous. For 15 years, I've been paralyzed with fear. Fear that Gomez would say something, do something in his big, lumbering Gomez callousness, and Henry doesn't mind. Or does he? How was it? He asks, quite casually, with his back to me as he messes with the coffee maker. I pick my words with care. Different. I mean, without getting real critical of Gomez. Oh, go ahead. It was sort of like being a china shop and trying to get off with a bull. He's bigger than me. Henry states this as fact. I wouldn't know about now, but back then he had no finesse at all. He actually smoked a cigarette while he was fucking me. Henry winces. I get up, walk over to him. I'm sorry. It was a mistake. He pulls me to him, and I say softly into his collar, I was waiting very patiently. But then I can't go on. Henry is stroking my hair. It's okay, Claire, he says. It's not so bad. I wonder if he is comparing the Claire he has just seen in 1989 with the duplicitous me in his arms. And, as if reading my mind, he says, Any other surprises? That was it. God, you can really keep a secret. I look at Henry, and he stares back at me. And I can tell that I have altered for him somehow. It made me understand better. It made me appreciate. You're trying to tell me that I did not suffer by comparison? Yes. I kiss him, tentatively, and after a moment of hesitation, Henry begins to kiss me back. And before too long, we are on our way to being all right again. Better than all right. I told him, and it was okay, and he still loves me. My whole body feels lighter, and I sigh with the goodness of confessing, finally, and not even having a penance, not one Hail Mary or Our Father. I feel like I've walked away scot-free from a totaled car. Out there, somewhere, Henry and I are making love on a green blanket in a meadow, and Gomez is looking at me sleepily and reaching for me with his enormous hands, and everything. Everything is happening now, but it's too late, as usual, to change any of it. And Henry and I unwrap each other on the studio couch like brand new, never before, boxes of chocolate. And it's not too late. Not yet, anyway. Saturday, April 14th, 1990. Claire is 18. 6:43 a.m. I open my eyes, and I don't know where I am. Cigarette smell. Venetian blind shadow across cracked yellow wall. I turn my head, and beside me, sleeping in his bed, is Gomez. Suddenly I remember, and I panic. Henry. Henry will kill me. Charisse will hate me. I sit up. Gomez's bedroom is a wreck of overfilled ashtrays, clothes, law textbooks, newspapers, dirty dishes. My clothes lie in a small, accusing pile on the floor beside me. Gomez sleeps beautifully. He looks serene. Not like a guy who's just cheated on his girlfriend with his girlfriend's best friend. His blonde hair is wild, not in its usual perfect, controlled state. He looks like an overgrown boy, exhausted from too many boyish games. My head is pounding. My insides feel like they've been beaten. I get up, shakily, and walk down the hall to the bathroom, which is dank and mold-infested and filled with shaving paraphernalia and damp towels. Once I'm in the bathroom, I'm not sure what I wanted. I pee, and I wash my face with the hard soap sliver, and I look at myself in the mirror to see if I look any different, to see if Henry will be able to tell just by looking at me. I look kind of nauseous, but otherwise I just look the way I look at 7 in the morning. The house is quiet. There's a clock ticking somewhere nearby. Gomez shares this house with 2 other guys, friends who are also at Northwestern's law school. I don't want to run into anyone. I go back to Gomez's room and sit on the bed. Good morning. Gomez smiles at me, reaches out to me. I recoil and burst into tears. Whoa, kitten! Claire, baby, hey, hey! He scrambles up and soon I am weeping in his arms. I think of all the times I have cried on Henry's shoulder. Where are you? I wonder desperately. I need you, here and now. Gomez is saying my name over and over. What am I doing here, without any clothes on, crying in the embrace of an equally naked Gomez? He reaches over and hands me a box of tissue, and I blow my nose and wipe my eyes, and then I look at him with a look of unconditional despair. And he looks back at me in confusion. Okay now? No, how can I be okay? Yeah. What's wrong? I shrug. Gomez shifts into cross-examining fragile witness mode. Claire, have you ever had sex before? I nod. Is it Charisse? You feel bad about it because of Charisse? I nod. Did I do something wrong? I shake my head. Claire, who is Henry? I gape at him, incredulously. How do you know? Now I've done it. Shit. Son of a bitch. Gomez leans over and grabs his cigarettes from the bedside table and lights one. He waves out the match and takes a deep drag. With a cigarette in his hand, Gomez seems more dressed, somehow, even though he's not. He silently offers me one, and I take it, even though I don't smoke. It just seems like the thing to do, and it buys me time to think about what to say. He lights it for me, gets up, rummages around in his closet, finds a blue bathrobe that doesn't look all that clean, and hands it to me. I put it on. It's huge. I sit on the bed, smoking, and watching Gomez put on a pair of jeans. Even in my wretchedness, I observe that Gomez is beautiful. Tall and broad and large. an entirely different sort of beauty from Henry's lithe panther wildness. I immediately feel horrible for comparing. Gomez sets an ashtray next to me and sits down on the bed and looks at me. You were talking in your sleep to someone named Henry. Damn. What did I say? Mostly just Henry over and over, like you were calling someone to come to you. And I'm sorry. And once you said, well, you weren't here, like you were really angry. Who is Henry? Henry is my lover. Claire, you don't have a lover. Charisse and I have seen you almost every day for 6 months, and you never date anyone, and no one ever calls you. Henry is my lover. He's been gone for a while, and he'll be back in the fall of 1991. Where is he? Somewhere nearby. I don't know. Gomez thinks I am making this up. For no reason, I am determined to make him believe me. I grab my purse, open my wallet, and show Gomez the photo of Henry. He studies it carefully. I've seen this guy. Well, no, someone a lot like him. This guy is too old to be the same person, but that guy's name was Henry. My heart is beating like a mad thing. I try to be casual as I ask, where did you see him? At clubs, mostly Exit and Smart Bar. But I can't imagine that he's your guy. He's a maniac. Chaos attends his every move. He's an alcoholic, and he's just, I don't know, he's really rough on women, or so I hear. Violent? I can't imagine Henry hitting a woman. No, I don't know. What's his last name? I don't know. Listen, kitten, this guy would chew you up and spit you out. He's not at all what you need. I smile. He's exactly what I need, but I know that it is futile to go chasing through clubland trying to find him. What do I need? Me? Except you don't seem to think so. You have Charisse. What do you want me for? I just want you. I don't know why. You a Mormon or something? Gomez says very seriously, Claire, I... Look, Claire, don't say it. Really, I... No. I don't want to know. I get up, stub out my cigarette, and start to put my clothes on. Gomez sits very still and watches me dress. I feel stale and dirty and creepy putting on last night's party dress in front of Gomez, but I try not to let it show. I can't do the long zipper in the back of the dress, and Gomez gravely helps me with it. Claire, don't be mad. I'm not mad at you. I'm mad at myself. This guy must be really something if he can walk away from a girl like you and expect you to be around 2 years later. I smile at Gomez. He is amazing. I can see that I have hurt Gomez's feelings. Gomez, I'm sorry. If I was free and you were free... Gomez shakes his head, and before I know it, he's kissing me. I kiss back. And there's just a moment when I wonder. I've got to go now, Gomez. He nods. I leave.
Friday, April 27th, 1990. Henry is 26. Ingrid and I are at the Riviera Theater, dancing our tiny brains out to the dulcet tones of Iggy Pop. Ingrid and I are always happiest together when we're dancing or fucking or anything else that involves physical activity and no talking. Right now, we are in heaven. We're way up front and Mr. Pop is whipping us all into a compact ball of manic energy. I told Ing once that she dances like a German and she didn't like it. But it's true. She dances seriously, like lives are hanging in the balance, like precision dancing can save the starving children in India. It's great. The Igster is crooning, I'm so pent up like this, I can't stay. and I know exactly how he feels. It's moments like this that I see the point of me and Ingrid. We slash and burn our way through Lust for Life, China Doll, Fun Time. Ingrid and I have taken enough speed to launch a mission to Pluto, and I have that weird, high-pitched feeling and a deep conviction that I can do this, be here for the rest of my life, and be perfectly content. Ingrid is sweating. Her white t-shirt has glued itself to her body in an interesting and aesthetically pleasing way, and I consider peeling it off of her, but refrain. Because she's not wearing a bra, and I'll never hear the end of it. We dance, Iggy Pop sings, and sadly, inevitably, after three encores, the concert finally ends. I feel great. As we file out with our fellow elated and pumped-up concert-goers, I wonder what we should do next. Ingrid takes off to go and stand in the long line for the ladies' room, and I wait for her out on Broadway. I'm watching a yuppie in a BMW argue with a valet parking kid over an illegal space when this huge blonde guy walks up to me. "Henry?" he asks. I wonder if I'm about to be served with a court summons or something. "Yeah?" Claire says hello. Who the hell is Claire? "Sorry, wrong number." Ingrid walks up, looking once again like her usual Bond girl self. She sizes up this guy, who's a pretty fine specimen of guyhood. I put my arm around her. The guy smiles. "Sorry, you must have a double out there." My heart contracts. Something's going on that I don't get. A little of my future seeping into now. But now is not the moment to investigate. He seems pleased about something and excuses himself and walks away. "What was that all about?" says Ingrid. "I think he thought I was someone else." I shrug. Ingrid looks worried. Just about everything about me seems to worry Ingrid, so I ignore it. "Hey, Ing, what shall we do next?" I feel like leaping tall buildings in a single bound. "My place? Brilliant." We stop at Margie's Candies for ice cream, and soon we're in the car chanting, "Ice cream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream," and laughing like deranged children. Later, in bed with Ingrid, I wonder who Claire is. But then I figure there's probably no answer to that, so I forget about it. Friday, February 18th, 2005. Henry is 41, Claire is 33. I'm taking Charisse to the opera. It's Tristan und Isolde. The reason I'm here with Charisse and not Claire has to do with Claire's extreme aversion to Wagner. I'm not a huge Wagnerite either, but we have season tickets and I just as soon go as not. We were discussing this one evening at Charisse and Gomez's place, and Charisse wistfully said that she'd never been to the opera. The upshot of it all is that Charisse and I are getting out of a taxi in front of the Lyric Opera House, and Claire is at home minding Alba and playing Scrabble with Alicia, who's visiting us this week. I'm not really in the mood for this. When I stopped at their house to collect Charisse, Gomez winked at me and said, "Don't keep her out too late, son," in his best clueless parent voice. I can't remember the last time Charisse and I did anything by ourselves. I like Charisse very much, but I don't have much of anything to say to her. I shepherd Charisse through the crowd. She moves slowly, taking in the splendid lobby, marble, and sweeping high galleries full of elegantly understated rich people and students with faux fur and pierced noses. Charisse smiles at the libretto vendors, two tuxedoed gents who stand at the entrance to the lobby singing, "Libretto, libretto, buy yourself a libretto," in two-part harmony. No one I know is here. Wagnerites are the green berets of opera fans. They're made of sterner stuff, and they all know each other. There's a lot of air-kissing going on as Charisse and I walk upstairs to the mezzanine. Claire and I have a private box. It's one of our indulgences. I pull back the curtain, and Charisse steps in and says, "Oh." I take her coat and drape it over a chair and do the same with mine. We settle ourselves. Charisse crosses her ankles and folds her small hands in her lap. Her black hair gleams in the low, soft light. And with her dark lipstick and dramatic eyes, Charisse is like an exquisite, wicked child, all dressed up, allowed to stay up late with the grown-ups. She sits and drinks in the beauty of the Lyric, the ornate gold and green screen that shields the stage, the ripples of cascading plaster that rim every arch and dome, the excited murmur of the crowd. The lights go down and Cherise flashes me a grin. The screen rises, and we are on a boat, and Isolde is singing. I lean back in my chair and lose myself in the current of her voice. 4 hours, one love potion, and a standing ovation later, I turn to Cherise. Well, how did you like it? She smiles. It was silly, wasn't it? But the singing made it not silly. I hold out her coat and she feels around for the armhole, finds it and shrugs on the coat. Silly? I guess. But I'm willing to pretend that Jane Eglind is young and beautiful instead of a 300-pound cow because she has the voice of Euterpe. Euterpe? The muse of music. We join the stream of exiting, satiated listeners. Downstairs we flow out into the cold. I march us up Wacker Drive a bit and manage to snare a cab after only a few minutes. I'm about to give the cabbie Cherise's address when she says, "Henry, let's go have coffee. I don't want to go home yet." I tell the cabbie to take us to Don's Coffee Club, which is on Jarvis at the northern edge of the city. Cherise chats about the singing, which was sublime, about the sets, which we both agree were not inspired, about the moral difficulties of enjoying Wagner when you know he was an anti-Semitic asshole whose biggest fan was Hitler. When we get to Don's, the joint is jumping. Don is holding court in an orange Hawaiian shirt, and I wave to him. We find a small table in the back. Cherise orders cherry pie a la mode and coffee, and I order my usual peanut butter and jelly sandwich and coffee. Perry Como is crooning from the stereo, and there's a haze of cigarette smoke drifting over the dinette sets and garage sale paintings. Cherise leans her head on her hand and sighs. This is so great. I feel like sometimes I forget what it was like to be a grown-up. You guys don't go out much? Cherise smushes her ice cream around with her fork, laughs. Joe does this. He says it tastes better if it's mushy. God, I'm picking up their bad habits instead of them learning my good ones. She eats a bite of pie. To answer your question, we do go out, but it's almost always to political stuff. Gomez is thinking about running for alderman. I swallow my coffee the wrong way and start to cough. When I can talk again, I say, "You're joking. Isn't that going over to the dark side? Gomez is always slamming the city administration." Cherise gives me a wry look. He's decided to change the system from within. He's burned out on horrible child abuse cases. I think he's convinced himself that he could actually improve things if he had some clout. Maybe he's right. Cherise shakes her head. I liked it better when we were young anarchist revolutionaries. I'd rather blow things up than kiss ass. I smile. I never realized that you were more radical than Gomez. Oh, yeah. Actually, it's just that I'm not as patient as Gomez. I want action. Gomez is patient? Oh, sure. I mean, look at the whole thing with Claire. Cherise abruptly stops, looks at me. What whole thing? I realize as I ask the question that this is why we're here. That Cherise has been waiting to talk about this. I wonder what she knows that I don't know. I wonder if I want to know what Cherise knows. I don't think I want to know anything. Cherise looks away and then back at me. She looks down at her coffee, puts her hands around the cup. Well, I thought you knew, but, like, Gomez is in love with Claire. Yes? I'm not helping her out with this. Cherise is tracing the grain of the table's veneer with her finger. So, Claire's been telling him to take a hike, and he thinks that if he just hangs in there long enough, something will happen, and he'll end up with her. Something will happen? To you. Cherise meets my eyes. I feel ill. Excuse me, I say to her. I get up and make my way to the tiny Marilyn Monroe plastered bathroom. I splash my face with cold water. I lean against the wall with my eyes closed. When it becomes obvious that I'm not going anywhere, I walk back into the cafe and sit down. Sorry, you were saying? Cherise looks scared and small. Henry, she says quietly. Tell me.
Tell you what, Cherise?
Tell me you aren't going anywhere. Tell me Claire doesn't want Gomez. Tell me everything's going to work out,
or tell me it's all shit, I don't know. Just tell me what happens. Her voice shakes. She puts her hand on my arm and I force myself not to pull away. You'll be fine, Charisse. It'll be okay. She stares at me, not believing and wanting to believe. I lean back in my chair. He won't leave you. She sighs. And you? I'm silent. Charisse stares at me and then she bows her head. Let's go home, she says finally. And we do.
Sunday, June 12th, 2005. Claire is 34, Henry is 41. It's a sunny Sunday afternoon, and I walk into the kitchen to find Henry standing by the window staring out at the backyard. He beckons me over. I stand beside him and look out. Alba is playing in the yard with an older girl. The girl is about 7. She has long dark hair, and she is barefoot. She wears a dirty t-shirt with the Cubs logo on it. They are both sitting on the ground facing each other. The girl has her back to us. Alba is smiling at her and gesturing with her hands as though she is flying. The girl shakes her head and laughs. I look at Henry. Who is that? That's Alba. Yes, but who's with her? Henry smiles, but his eyebrows pull together so that the smile seems worried. Claire, that's Alba when she's older. She's time traveling. My God. I stare at the girl. She swivels and points at the house, and I see a quick profile, and then she turns away again. Should we go out there? No, she's fine. If they want to come in here, they will. I'd love to meet her. Better not, Henry begins, but as he speaks, the two Albas jump up and come racing toward the back door, hand in hand. They burst into the kitchen laughing. Mama, Mama, says my Alba, 3-year-old Alba, pointing, Look, a big girl Alba. The other Alba grins and says, Hi, Mama. And I am smiling, and I say, Hello, Alba. When she turns and sees Henry and cries out, Daddy! And runs to him, throws her arms around him, and starts to cry. Henry glances at me, bends over Alba, rocking her, and whispers something in her ear.
Claire is white-faced. She stands watching us, holding small Alba's hand. Alba, who stands watching open-mouthed as her older self clings to me, weeping. I lean down to Alba, whisper in her ear, Don't tell Mama I died, okay? She looks up at me, tears clinging to her long lashes, lips quivering in nods. Claire is holding a tissue, telling Alba to blow her nose, hugging her. Alba allows herself to be led off to wash her face. Small Alba, present Alba, wraps herself around my leg. Why, Daddy? Why is she sad? Fortunately, I don't have to answer because Claire and Alba have returned. Alba is wearing one of Claire's t-shirts and a pair of my cutoffs. Claire says, Hey, everybody, why don't we go get an ice cream? Both Albas smile. Small Alba dances around us yelling, Ice cream! You scream! Ice cream! You scream! We pile into the car. Claire driving, 3-year-old Alba in the front seat, and 7-year-old Alba in the back seat with me. She leans against me. I put my arm around her. Nobody says a word except little Alba, who says, Look, Alba, a doggie! Look, Alba! Look, Alba! Until her older self says, Yeah, Alba, I see. Claire drives us to Zephyr. We settle into a blue glitter vinyl booth and order 2 banana splits, a chocolate malt, and a soft-serve vanilla cone with sprinkles. The girls suck down their banana splits like vacuum cleaners. Claire and I toy with our ice cream, not looking at each other. Claire says, Alba, what's going on? In your present. Alba darts a look at me. Not much, she says. Gramps is teaching me Saint-Saëns' second violin concerto. You're in a play at school, I prompt. I am? Not yet, I guess. Oh, sorry, I say. I guess that's not till next year. It goes on like this. We make halting conversation, working around what we know. What we must protect Claire and small Alba from knowing. After a while, older Alba puts her head in her arms on the table. Tired? Claire asks her. She nods. We'd better go, I tell Claire. We pay, and I pick Alba up. She's limp, almost asleep in my arms. Claire scoops up little Alba, who's hyper from all the sugar. Back in the car as we're cruising up Lincoln Avenue, Alba vanishes. She's gone back, I say to Claire. She holds my eyes in the rearview mirror for a few moments.
Back where, Daddy? Asks Alba. Back where?
Later. I finally managed to get Alba to take a nap. Henry is sitting on our bed, drinking scotch and staring out the window at some squirrels chasing each other around the grape arbor. I walk over and sit down next to him. Hey, I say. Henry looks at me, puts his arm around me, pulls me to him. Hey, he says. Are you going to tell me what that was all about? I ask him. Henry puts down his drink and starts to undo the buttons on my shirt. Can I get away with not telling you? No. I unbuckle his belt and open the button of his jeans. Are you sure? He's kissing my neck. Yes. I slide his zipper down, run my hand under his shirt, over his stomach. Because you don't really want to know. Henry breathes into my ear and runs his tongue around the rim. I shiver. He takes off my shirt, undoes the clasp of my bra. My breasts fall loose and I lie back, watching Henry stripping off his jeans and underwear and shirt. He climbs onto the bed and I say, socks. Oh yeah. He takes off his socks. We look at each other. You're just trying to distract me, I say. Henry caresses my stomach. I'm trying to distract myself. If I also manage to distract you, that's a bonus. You have to tell me. No, I don't. He cups my breasts in his hands, runs his thumbs over my nipples. I'll imagine the worst. Go ahead. I raise my hips, and Henry pulls off my jeans and my underwear. He straddles me, leans over me, kisses me. Oh, God, I think. What can it be? What is the worst? I close my eyes. A memory. The meadow. A cold day in my childhood, running over dead grass. There was a noise. He called my name. Claire? Henry is biting my lips gently. Where are you? 1984. Henry pauses and says, why? I think that's where it happens. Where what happens? Whatever it is you're afraid to tell me. Henry rolls off of me and we are lying side by side. Tell me about it, he says. It was early, a day in the fall. Daddy and Mark were out deer hunting. I woke up. I thought I heard you calling me, and I ran out into the meadow, and you were there, and you and Daddy and Mark were all looking at something. But Daddy made me go back to the house, so I never saw what you were looking at. Oh? I went back there later in the day. There was a place in the grass, all soaked in blood. Henry says nothing. He presses his lips together. I wrap my arms around him, hold him tightly. I say, the worst. Hush, Claire. But, shh. Outside it is still a golden afternoon. Inside we are cold, and we cling together for warmth. Alba in her bed sleeps and dreams of ice cream, dreams the small, contented dreams of three. While another Alba, somewhere in the future, dreams of wrapping her arms around her father, and wakes up to find... what? The episode of the Monroe Street Parking Garage. Monday, January 7th, 2006. Claire is 34, Henry is 42. We are sleeping deep early morning winter sleep when the phone rings. I snap into wakefulness, my heart surging, and realize Henry is there beside me. He reaches over me and picks up the phone. I glance at the clock. It's 4:32 a.m.
"Hello?"
says Henry. He listens for a long minute. I am wide awake now. Henry is expressionless.
"Okay. Stay there. We'll leave right now."
He leans over and replaces the receiver. "Who was it?"
"Me. It was me. I'm down in the Monroe Street parking garage, no clothes, 15 degrees below zero. God, I hope the car starts."
We jump out of bed and throw on yesterday's clothes. Henry is booted and has his coat on before I'm in my jeans, and he runs out to start the car. I stuff Henry's shirt and long underwear and jeans and socks and boots and extra coat and mittens and a blanket into a shopping bag, wake Alba and stuff her into her coat and boots, fly into my coat and out the door. I pull out of the garage before the car is warmed up and it dies. I restart it, we sit for a minute, and I try again. It snowed 6 inches yesterday and Ainsley is rutted with ice. Alba is whining in her car seat and Henry shushes her. When we get to Lawrence, I speed up and in 10 minutes we are on the drive. There's no one out at this hour. The Honda's heater purrs. Over the lake, the sky is becoming lighter. Everything is blue and orange, brittle in the extreme cold. As we sail down Lakeshore Drive, I have a strong déjà vu. The cold. The lake in dreamy silence. The sodium glow of the streetlights. I've been here before. Been here before. I'm deeply enmeshed in this moment, and it stretches on, carrying me away from the strangeness of the thing into awareness of the duplicity of now. Although we are speeding through this winter cityscape, time stands immobile. We pass Irving, Belmont, Fullerton, LaSalle. I exit at Michigan. We fly down the deserted corridor of expensive shops, Oak Street, Chicago, Randolph, Monroe, and now we are diving down into the subterranean concrete world of the parking garage. I take the ticket the ghostly female machine voice offers me.
"Drive to the northwest end," says Henry. "The payphone by the security station."
I follow his instructions. The déjà vu is gone. I feel as though I've been abandoned by a protective angel. The garage is virtually empty. I speed across acres of yellow lines to the payphone. The receiver dangles from its cord. No Henry. "Maybe you got back to the present?"
"But maybe not."
Henry is confused, and so am I. We get out of the car. It's cold down here. My breath condenses and vanishes. I don't feel as though we should leave, but I don't have any idea what might have happened. I walk over to the security station and peer in the window. No guard. The video monitors show empty concrete. Shit. Where would I go?
Let's drive around.
We get back into the car and cruise slowly through the vast pillared chambers of vacant space, past signs directing us to go slow, more parking, remember your car's location. No Henry anywhere. We look at each other in defeat. "When were you coming from?"
I didn't say.
We drive home in silence. Alba is sleeping. Henry stares out the window. The sky is cloudless and pink in the east, and there are more cars out now, early commuters. As we wait for the stoplight at Ohio Street, I hear seagulls squawking. The streets are dark with salt and water. The city is soft, white, obscured by snow.
Everything is beautiful. I am detached. I am a movie. We are seemingly unscathed, but sooner or later, there will be hell to pay. Birthday. Thursday, June 15th, 2006. Claire is 35. Tomorrow is Henry's birthday. I'm in vintage vinyl, trying to find an album he will love that he doesn't already have. I was kind of counting on asking Vaughn, the owner of the shop, for help, because Henry's been coming here for years. But there's a high school kid behind the counter. He's wearing a Seven Dead Arson t-shirt, and probably wasn't even born when most of the stuff in the shop was being recorded. I flip through the bins. Sex Pistols, Patti Smith, Supertramp, Matthew Sweet. Fish, Pixies, Pogues, Pretenders. B-52s, Kate Bush, Buzzcocks. Echo and the Bunnymen. The Art of Noise. The Nails. The Clash, The Cramps, The Cure. Television. I pause over an obscure Velvet Underground retread, trying to remember if I've seen it lying around the house, but on closer scrutiny I realize it's just a mishmash of stuff Henry has on other albums. Dazzling Killmen, Dead Kennedys. Vaughn comes in carrying a huge box, heaves it behind the counter, and goes back out. He does this a few more times, and then he and the kids start to unpack the boxes, piling LPs onto the counter, exclaiming over various things I've never heard of. I walk over to Vaughn and mutely fan three LPs before him. "Hi, Claire," he says, grinning hugely. "How's it going?" "Hi, Vaughn. Tomorrow's Henry's birthday. Help." He eyeballs my selections. "He's already got those two," he says, nodding at Lilliput and the Breeders. "And that's really awful," indicating the Plasmatics. "Great cover, though, huh?"
"Yeah. Do you have anything in that box he might like?"
"Nah, this is all 50s. Some old lady died. You might like this. I just got this yesterday."
He pulls a Golden Palominos compilation out of the new arrivals bin. There's a couple new things on it, so I take it. Suddenly, Vaughn grins at me.
"I've got something really oddball for you. I've been saving it for Henry."
He steps behind the counter and fishes around in the depths for a minute.
"Here."
Vaughn hands me an LP in a blank white jacket. I slide the record out and read the label. Annette Lynn Robinson, Paris Opera, May 13th, 1968, Lulu. I look at Vaughn questioningly.
"Yeah, not his usual thing, huh? It's a bootleg of a concert. It doesn't officially exist. He asked me to keep an eye out for her stuff a while back, but it's not my usual thing either, so I found it, and then I kept forgetting to tell him. I listened to it. It's really nice. Good sound quality."
"Thank you," I whisper.
"You're welcome. Hey, what's the big deal?"
"She's Henry's mother." Vaughn raises his eyebrows and his forehead scrunches up comically.
"No kidding. Yeah, he looks like her. Huh, that's interesting. You'd think he would have mentioned it."
"He doesn't talk about her much. She died when he was little, in a car accident."
"Oh, that's right. I sort of remember that. Well, can I find anything else for you?"
"No, that's it." I pay Vaughn and leave, hugging the voice of Henry's mother to me as I walk down Davis Street in an ecstasy of anticipation.
Friday, June 16th, 2006. Henry is 43, Claire is 35. It's my 43rd birthday. My eyes pop open at 6:46 a.m. even though I have the day off from work, and I can't get back to sleep. I look over at Claire, and she's utterly abandoned to slumber, arms cast apart and hair fanned over her pillow willy-nilly. She looks beautiful, even with creases from the pillowcase across her cheeks. I get out of bed carefully, go to the kitchen, and start the coffee. In the bathroom, I run the water for a while, waiting for it to get hot. We should get a plumber in here, but we never get around to it. Back in the kitchen, I pour a cup of coffee, carry it to the bathroom, and balance it on the sink. I lather my face and start to shave. Ordinarily, I'm expert at shaving without actually looking at myself, but today, in honor of my birthday, I take inventory. My hair has gone almost white. There's a bit of black left at the temples, and my eyebrows are still completely black. I've grown it out some, not as long as I used to wear it before I met Claire, but not short either. My skin is wind-roughened, and there are creases at the edges of my eyes and across my forehead, and lines that run from my nostrils to the corners of my mouth. My face is too thin. All of me is too thin. Not Auschwitz thin, but not normal thin either. Early stages of cancer thin, perhaps. Heroin addict thin. I don't want to think about it, so I continue shaving. I rinse off my face, apply aftershave, step back, and survey the results. At the library yesterday, someone remembered that it's my birthday. And so Roberto, Isabel, Matt, Catherine, and Amelia gathered me up and took me to Bow Tie for lunch. I know there's been some talk at work about my health, about why I've suddenly lost so much weight and the fact that I've recently aged rapidly. Everyone was extra nice, the way people are to AIDS victims and chemotherapy patients. I almost longed for someone to just ask me, so I can lie to them and get it over with. But instead, we joked around and ate pad thai and prick king, cashew chicken and pad siu. Amelia gave me a pound of killer Colombian coffee beans. Catherine, Matt, Roberto, and Isabel splurged and got me the Getty facsimile of the Mera Calligraphy Monumenta, which I've been lusting after in the Newberry bookstore for ages. I look up at them, heartstruck, and I realize that my co-workers think I'm dying. "You guys," I said, and I couldn't think how to go on, so I didn't. It's not often that words fail me. Claire gets up, Alba wakes up. We all get dressed and pack the car. We're going to Brookfield Zoo with Gomez and Charisse and their kids. We spend the day ambling around looking at monkeys and flamingos, polar bears and otters. Alba likes the big cats best. Rosa holds Alba's hand and tells her about dinosaurs. Gomez does a great impression of a chimp, and Max and Joe rampage around, pretending to be elephants and playing handheld video games. Charisse and Claire and I stroll aimlessly, talking about nothing, soaking in the sunlight. At 4 o'clock, the kids are all tired and cranky, and we pack them back in the cars, promise to do it again soon, and go home. The babysitter arrives promptly at 7. Claire bribes and threatens Alba to be good, and we escape. We're dressed to the nines at Claire's insistence, and as we sail south on Lakeshore Drive, I realize that I don't know where we're going. "You'll see," says Claire. "It's not a surprise party, is it?" I ask apprehensively. "No," she assures me. Claire exits the drive at Roosevelt and threads her way through Pilsen, a Hispanic neighborhood just south of downtown. Groups of kids are playing in the streets, and we weave around them and finally park near 20th and Racine. Claire leads me to a rundown two-flat and rings the bell at the gate. We're buzzed in, and we make our way through the trash-littered yard and up precarious stairs. Claire knocks on one of the doors, and it's opened by Lourdes, a friend of Claire's from art school. Lourdes smiles and beckons us inside. And as we step in, I see that the apartment has been transformed into a restaurant with only one table. Beautiful smells are wafting around, and the table is laid with white damask, china, candles. A record player stands on a heavy carved sideboard. In the living room are cages full of birds. Parrots, canaries, tiny lovebirds. Lourdes kisses my cheek and says, "Happy birthday, Henry." And a familiar voice says, "Yeah, happy birthday." I stick my head into the kitchen, and there's Nell. She's stirring something in a saucepan, and she doesn't even stop when I wrap my arms around her and lift her slightly off the ground. "Woo-wee," she says. "You've been eating your Wheaties." Claire hugs Nell, and they smile at each other. "He looks pretty surprised," Nell says, and Claire just smiles even more broadly. "Go on and sit down," Nell commands. "Dinner is ready." We sit facing each other at the table. Lourdes brings small plates of exquisitely arranged antipasti. Transparent prosciutto with pale yellow melon, mussels that are mild and smoky, slender strips of carrot and beet that taste of fennel and olive oil. In the candlelight, Claire's skin is warm, and her eyes are shadowed. The pearls she's wearing